I don't work for Gov. There's one problem. The shortest one yet. Okay. Well, some people come by office hours. I saw some things that were tripping people up, but did everybody feel like through the process they understood? Are there questions remaining? You have the floor.
Yeah. How to get the efficiency from the derived charges once you add it in the switching boxes.
Okay. So once you have that equivalent circuit, that's modeling the average behavior of your converter. And the output power and the input power are modeling the average output power and input power of your circuit. So fallback always going to be correct is to calculate the output power and the input power of that circuit. Vin times In, Vout times Iout, then divide output power by input power. So what you're likely referring to is the case where, particularly in the buck, with these current sources at the input, this nice expression no longer falls out where the conversion ratio is ideal times efficiency. And I didn't want to address that maybe last class, but as I mentioned that nice format, I said that anytime you have conduction losses, this is true. With switching losses, it can occasionally not be. And the reason it falls out like that is because in that buck case, you have VG and then these current sources from reverse recovery. And then you go into your transformer and the rest of the circuit, DC transformer. So this thing here doesn't affect anything about the voltage seen by the rest of the circuit. Whether this current is zero or infinity doesn't matter because it's just in parallel with an ideal voltage source. So this voltage is VG regardless of this current. It has no effect on the voltage conversion ratio. It's just pulling extra power from the input. So we could simplify down and you could do the efficiency the normal way, calculate the conversion ratio, get that efficiency. Then you'd have to add in that there's some additional losses being pulled directly from the input source to get your actual efficiency. But in that case, that format would only model the conduction losses, not the switching losses. Right. But like I said, always true. This was what IL, this is DIL. So if you calculate PN is VG times DIL plus, we should call this I reverse recovery. Then this term causes your input power to increase. Your output power is V squared over R. Your input power going up for the same output power is going to decrease your efficiency. So that format's a nice little trick to do things a little bit quicker sometimes, but generally always correct. Output power over input power, just calculate them for the circuit. Any other remaining questions on the homework? Okay. All right, we'll move on then. Stop me if something comes up. So what were we talking about last time? We're still on this example converter. We had looked at PN diode operation, this reverse recovery phenomena, and then we mentioned one way to get rid of it is to use a different type of diode, in this case, a Schottky diode, which is a majority carrier device that has no reverse recovery. We plugged one of those into our converter and found that we eliminated a whole lot of losses, but we still had some remaining loss mechanisms which weren't modeled by my pure conduction loss model. Thought I should get 97.6% efficiency, I'm only getting 96.9. So we went and looked at the switching waveforms and found that despite getting rid of reverse recovery, we still have some much smaller current spike during the switching instant. I wanted to figure out what's going on during the switching time now. In order to look at that, kind of now dove into the high-level semiconductor physics of a MOSFET, what's going on inside of this thing. This is a VD MOS, the power MOSFET. which is a very big die with a bunch of small unit cells in parallel, and I build up the size of this die to get a low on resistance. I make it tall enough to block the voltage I want by extending this N minus region. Inherent in that is that when it is blocking voltage, I get these different capacitances between all of the terminals. Some of them, particularly gate to drain and drain to source capacitances, are nonlinear with respect to voltage because they go across this depletion region. Some of them really just look like linear capacitors, just conductor-conductor oxide in the middle. So when we look at data sheet of a MOSFET, it'll give us information about these different parasitic capacitances. Typically, we'll have a plot like this of the nonlinearity of these voltage-dependent capacitors with respect to the drain-to-source voltage. So my COSS, which is really my drain-to-source capacitance, and my gate-to-drain capacitance start at some large value. And then as the depletion region expands, their effective parallel plates get further apart and the capacitance drops. Analysis of nonlinear capacitances is going to be out of scope of this course. I mentioned EC 581 will cover that. So there's a whole lot more about all these different switching loss mechanisms. If you're interested in that, what we'll do for the rest of the day and most of the rest of the class is just assume these can be modeled as linear, constant valued capacitances. The other thing we may be interested in is this gate charge. Gate charge is the total charge that needs to be supplied to the gate in order to bring the gate to source voltage up. We want to go from zero, when the device is in cutoff, all the way up to 10 volts to get it fully on with my lower on resistance. I need to supply, in this case, some 34 nanocoulombs of charge. And that curve itself has some weirdness to it. If it was just a constant CGS capacitance, then my Q versus V, so for a capacitance, Q is equal to CV. So if I had just a linear capacitor, this thing would just look like a straight line with some slope. But I see this kind of stair-step waveform, and that's because at this time, the device is actually switching. And when it switches, I see a big voltage transient across the gate-to-drain capacitance. And again, back here, even though the capacitance is smaller, if I see a big voltage change across it, that takes a fair amount of charge. So this is all going through the gate-to-drain. This down here is the gate-to-source, then back to the gate-to-source. If you look at this real closely, the gate-to-source capacitance changes a little bit. The slope here and here are slightly different. That's because as I actually get it turned on and create that inversion layer, my capacitance changes. Now I've got more conductors right underneath the gate. It gives me a stronger capacitance underneath the gate. Relatively minor detail. So what does this mean? There are a few different loss mechanisms that are going to arise because of this. On the next slide, I'm going to talk about just because of this drain to source capacitance, what does that do to our circuit operation? One that I'm not going to go into a lot of detail is something called overlap loss. Which is another type of switching power loss. And it occurs because of this effect, because of the fact that there is a non-zero amount of gate charge that goes to my MOSFET. So when I turn it on, I don't jump from off to on. I go from off to slightly on to in saturation as a more or less a current source to then out of saturation into triode at a higher resistance to then finally fully on at my low resistance. So this effect models the dynamics of VGS rise. And there's some energy associated with that because during this time, I'm really somewhere in between off and on, and I'm going to have simultaneous voltage and current. That's going to result in some loss. Model that, it depends on how you design the gate driver, the details of this gate charge are, currents and voltages are going through it. That's another type of switching loss we're not going to focus on here. But what I do want to talk about is how these capacitances, particularly the drain to source capacitance and the diode capacitance that we looked at previously, result in loss in the circuit. So I'm going to do that in the reference frame of this buck converter, where I'm going to assume we're operating with some IL and V, and I'm going to model the effects of the diode junction capacitance CJ and the MOSFET drain to source capacitance CDS. I'm going to assume everything else is ideal. So there's no reverse recovery in the diode, no gate charge in the MOSFET. Everything is ideal except for these two capacitances. Okay. So if I put these capacitances in, what's going to happen? Well, in each of my subintervals, we'll just have a fixed voltage across them that won't do anything. It's really only going to happen at the switching intervals, at the switching edges, that these capacitances come into play and alter anything about my circuit. I'm going to look at separately the MOSFET turn off. And the turn on. My two switching edges. So when the MOSFET turns off, I'm going to look at the drain to source voltage of the MOSFET. Be this. And switch node voltage. I'll do that one in a different color, which is also the diode voltage. VSW. When the MOSFET turns off, it's initially on, and at this point, I'm going to shut off my VGS, so VGS goes to zero. The drain to source voltage of the MOSFET, it's more or less ideal, should be zero up until then. And then at this point, it instantly goes into cutoff. MOSFET is now just an open, but its drain to source capacitance is still present and affecting circuit operation. So up to this same time, the diode is off and my switch node voltage should be up here at VG. So immediately at this time, the MOSFET turns off, but the diode cannot turn on. It still has VG voltage across it. I can't forward bias the diode when it's got a reverse voltage on it. And then my ideal converter, if I don't consider any of these capacitances, this just jumps down instantaneously, and then the diode turns on. But when I have capacitances now, I can't have this infinite DVDT. I have infinite DVDT on a capacitor that requires infinite current. And I don't have infinite current. The current I have is IL. Okay. So my circuit now, once this MOSFET is turned off, is going to look like VG CDS CJ. And my inductor, which has a fixed IL. Rest of it, I don't so much care about. This IL is all the current I have to charge and discharge these capacitors. So it's now going to split between CDS and CJ, now that no devices are on. And it's going to flow this way through CDS, this way through CJ. Switch node voltage, the way I defined it, positive minus. If I have this current coming up through CJ, that's going to tend to discharge CJ and bring the switch node voltage down. Flowing positive to negative forward through CDS, which is going to tend to charge CDS. So what I'm going to see is the switch node voltage drops and the drain to source voltage of the MOSFET rises. And they're going to do so with a slope of IL over CDS plus CJ. In this case, they both have to have the same slope because VDS plus VJ is VG, right? So the sum of them has to be constant. So however one much one goes down, the other has to go up in equal parts. Okay. So they're going to do this until my switch node voltage hits zero, at which point now the diode voltage is zero and it can begin to turn on and become forward bias, at which point it's going to clamp and all the current will go through the diode. This will be the end of my switching interval. The MOSFET drain to source ending up at VG, the diode ending up down here at zero. Okay, so what happened? Now I've inserted these two capacitances and their voltage has changed through the switching interval, which indicates that there's a change in the stored energy in these caps. Right? So the energy in a capacitor, 1/2 CV². I can look at each of these for my drain to source capacitance. The energy in it is now 1/2 CDS times VG². Beginning of the interval, it had zero energy. Now it's up at VG, so it's going to have 1/2 CV² energy stored in it. And this energy is stored in CDS. So as yet, no problem with that. It's not an energy loss. There's just this amount of energy has gone into that capacitor. My diode capacitance, EJ, it went from VG down to zero. So I have a negative change in energy in it. This energy came out of that capacitor and was supplied back to the rest of the circuit. So exactly where that goes, when modeling the inductor current is constant, it becomes a little bit nebulous, but it goes back and charges the inductor some. We look at this circuit, though. I've got nothing but caps, inductor, voltage source. So all that energy that's supplied back isn't lost. I've got no loss mechanisms in this thing, right? So this is just the shifting around of the stored energy in the circuit from one cap to another, from the inductor to the caps. So as yet, there is no power loss. Yes. Foreshadowing. Okay. So then we end up there. We go through a much longer time where the MOSFET is off, our full D prime TF. This is zoomed right in on that switching instance. This is less than 1% of the total switching period. So I'm going to have a long period where it's off. Then at the end of that, I'm going to turn the FET back on. I'm going to zoom in on that switching instance and again plot VDF. So here what happens, VDS, the MOSFET is up at VG. Then at this time, my VGS turned on. And I'm not modeling any sort of gate charge or any other parasitics about this MOSFET, so I can instantly just turn it on and the MOSFET becomes an on resistance or a short. And what's going to happen? Well, it's now got this parallel capacitance that has some voltage across it. And when I turn that MOSFET on, it's shorting that cap out. And it's going to the extent this is ideal, with a infinite spike of current in zero time, completely discharge that capacitor. I'm shorting it out. I'm just dissipating all of the energy of that cap inside this MOSFET. So I'm going to short it, drop VDS down to zero. In doing so, any energy that was left in that capacitance is now going to be lost in the MOSFET. Now, EDS, Austin MOSFET. What about my diode junction capacitance? Again, look at the switch node. It's going to have to do the opposite. Again, because V switch plus VDS is VG, here's my switch node voltage. So this diode is rapidly charged up to VG. Let's say this is what gave that capacitance the energy that we got back over here. Well, the question is, are there losses associated with that, with rapidly charging this cap up? What do people think? Let me sketch. That's the question I just asked you. You can't ask me that. This is IL, CJ, CDS. When I model the MOSFET turn on, I'm essentially saying I short a switch here, right? So for this, I'm talking about, well, ignore the diode capacitance for a second. Just look at the MOSFET capacitance. And the MOSFET shorts that out. All the energy is just going to dissipate right there. As soon as I short out that cap, its voltage has to go to zero because it's shorted. Whatever energy it has is lost. Now my question to you is, what about the diode? So that same switch being closed is going to force the voltage on that diode to go from zero to VG instantaneously, to the extent that the MOSFET's ideal. Lossy, not lossy. Let's see. So let's model this switching transition. And I'm going to do so with just a general circuit here. I'm going to say some voltage. I throw a switch. And I threw some resistance, charge, and capacitance. The switch turns on at t is equal to zero. And VC of zero is equal to zero. My capacitor initially has no voltage on it. When I close this switch, it's going to charge. If I wait long enough, it's going to charge to the input voltage V, right? So what are the losses in this circuit? What are the losses associated with charging this capacitor? Okay. So in the circuit, the losses are going to occur on the resistor. So I can say that the total losses are all of the energy dissipated on the resistor, which is going to be the integral from time zero to infinity of the current in the resistor times the voltage on the resistor dt. Where this is IR, this is VR. And there are a few ways I can solve out this integral. One way is to use kind of Laplace transforms to figure out the waveforms for my current and voltage. Solve what IR and VR are. You know that these should be exponentials, both of them. Capacitor is going to charge with an exponential up to V. The resistor is going to initially have V over R current and then decay down to zero. Multiply those two together, evaluate the integral of those exponentials, get my answer. A bit simpler way to do this is to use a chain rule on this integral. And what I'm going to do is say the current here through this loop, I, is the current at the input, is the current through the resistor, is the current through the capacitor. Everything has the same current because it's one loop, right? So I can rewrite this. Energy loss of my resistor is integral from zero to infinity of IR, which I'm going to write as the capacitor current, I sub C, times VR, which I'm going to write as input voltage minus capacitor voltage. Okay, now I know something about this capacitor current. I know I is equal to C dV dt for a capacitor. So I can replace that in. Integral from zero to infinity, E minus VC, my capacitor current, which is C dVC dt dt. And when I have this kind of setup, where I have an integral of a derivative with respect to the denominator of that derivative, this implies I can apply the chain rule to change the variable I'm integrating with respect to. So I can kind of cancel these two dt's and take my integral with respect to voltage instead of time. So what I'm going to get is this is now the integral of V minus VC times C. Now with respect to VC, and the thing I need to do is to change my limits of integration to be in terms of voltage instead of in terms of time. So at time zero, VC is zero. At time infinity, should be the input voltage V. So now I'm integrating from zero to V. And this integral is much simpler to take. This is equal to the C pulled out front. And then I'll have two terms, integral of V with respect to VC. It's just going to be V times VC, evaluated from zero to V. That's going to give me V squared. And then minus the integral of VC with respect to VC. Going to give me VC squared over 2. Plug in my limits, that's V squared over 2. V squared minus V squared over 2, this is 1/2 CV squared. So when I charge a cap from a voltage source through a resistor, I lose an equal amount of energy on that resistor as the energy that goes into the cap. This whole thing is 50% efficient. Half the energy is lost on the resistor, half the energy goes to the cap. Okay, but that's not the circuit you have. There's no resistor in there because you told me the MOSFET was more or less ideal. So, okay, what's right in LaTeX. What happens if R goes to zero? Do you think no loss now?
Yeah.
How many people think no loss? How many people think there is loss? Unwilling to commit. Okay, so take my derivation, and everywhere I use the resistance, plug in zero for it. What changes? So resistance doesn't matter what its value is, whether it's there or not. You lose this amount of energy to charge that cap from a voltage source. So even if there is no resistance there, still going to lose the same amount of energy. Reason I solved it this way is because there's no change in what you get here if you let R go to zero. If you had done this the other way I mentioned, by solving out the exponentials for both the current and the voltage, you have to take a limit as R goes to zero. The current becomes a Dirac delta function, and the voltage becomes a step, and it becomes somewhat messy math, but it confirms the same thing. Even if that resistance is gone, you're still losing this amount of energy to charge that cap. And the limit of zero resistance happens on the switch, because the switch, the exact moment it closes, it has a perfect step in voltage, but it has a spike of current to supply the charge necessary to get the cap to jump up to V. When you integrate those two together, you get the same 1/2 CV² energy loss. The moment where I have to apologize, because early in the course I told you if we have nothing but switches and caps, we don't have any losses. Well, we actually can. Okay? We can have switching type losses, even if that resistance is gone.
So where is it?
It'd be on the switch in that case. The switch is the thing that's going to have a zero time simultaneous voltage and current. A bit of a mathematical trick, perhaps, but in any real circuit, you have some minor amount of resistance, and it doesn't matter what that resistance is. Even if it could theoretically go to zero, you're going to have this amount of loss. Okay.
So in the actual converter, what is that, the loss there? Would that be on R1, or would that be on R, or just the MOSFET?
It would still be in the channel of the MOSFET. When it has R on, it'll be on R on. If it doesn't, it'll be on the actual channel of it. But at some point, we divorce from the ideality, and it occurs in the MOSFET, in the silicon of the MOSFET. Okay, so what does that mean? So we lost all of the energy in the drain to source capacitor because we shorted it out. We're also going to lose an equivalent amount of energy to whatever we put into the diode capacitance. That's the same case. I'm shorting this MOSFET and charging CJ. So I'm also going to lose CJ 1/2, EJ, excuse me. And then I'm going to have a total power loss due to these caps of EJ plus EDS times, I don't have room, FS. So I have these energy losses. They occur once every switching period. So I multiply by FS to get the average power associated with that. What we do with all switching loss mechanisms. So the MOSFET turns off. This is still a lossless transition, but we're kind of priming these caps. We put all of this energy in the CDF, and it just sits there. It's not lost yet. Not until the MOSFET turns on that we short it out and lose that energy. There is a class of converters that we won't get to in this course called resonant and soft switching converters that look at different modes of operation where I can get that energy back before I turn the MOSFET on. But this switching transition, I store it in CDF. If I change the circuit operation and somehow pull it back out of that cap before I turn the MOSFET on, then I can get rid of this loss. Okay. Questions on that? Okay, my next couple of slides are somewhat high level, just giving you an idea of we've solved out a pair of these loss mechanisms from switching losses. When you get into actual converter design, is this sufficient to cover everything? And the answer is kind of no. In advanced design for simple converters, this is probably enough to get a good model and design it. When you start looking at very high performance power electronics, there's a whole lot more complex phenomena going on. So this here is the switch node voltage in a buck converter, measured experimentally with two different devices, two different MOSFETs. You can see things like here, this is a synchronous buck converter you looked at a little bit in the homework. So it's two MOSFETs, inductor, cap resistor. You get it. This is a little bit of that effect. You looked at some in the homework. This is that body diode turning on. So you can see the switch node voltage. Once I turn off the low side set, voltage drops by a body diode drop for a very short amount of time, and then I turn on the high side to bring the voltage up. When I do, there is potentially some significant amount of ringing and overshoot due to any sort of parasitic inductances anywhere in this converter. These power converters are extremely sensitive to parasitic inductances in line with the switches, because ideally my switches should have square waves of current. If I try to put that through an inductance, that's an infinite DIDT, it's going to result in voltage and ringing. So we do a lot of things with how we actually physically lay out these converters to try to minimize those parasitic inductances. But no matter what, they're still present at all the terminals. In addition to all my parasitic capacitances, it causes difficulties with nonlinearities and ringing and all these bad switching behaviors that can cause overvoltage and excess loss. And then this overlap thing I mentioned, we can model how the channel of the MOSFET responds to switching, that it doesn't go from open to R on, but it goes through saturation as a current source. So this is some examples taken from some papers where they go through and try to model all this analytically, and it's a mess and not so useful. But there are a whole lot more effects going on. The couple types of switching losses we talked about, kind of derived expressions for, are dominant in some cases, and those can be a good predictor of switching losses in certain designs. In others where they're not, we can either go this route, where we try to analyze a more complex model of the switching behavior. The other approach is the double pulse test. This is a purely empirical model of switching loss. And what I mean by that is we essentially just construct a circuit to measure the energy that's dissipated every time it switches, get expressions for the energy of this MOSFET when it switches, measure it at different VDS and ID values, get plots for when it turns on and when it turns off, the function of current, voltage, and then my model is just my measurement results for it. Kind of common to do. Circuit looks like this. Got a DC supply and then an inductor. I start with that inductor having zero current, and then I turn on this so-called active device, causes the inductor current to ramp up. And then when it reaches the value I want to test, I turn it off, then back on again. So that at that current, I get a turn off and a turn on, and measure the voltage and current of it, record them, integrate them to get the energy. Okay. Now this incorporates all the different loss mechanisms going on, everything about the switching, just gives me a number. Here is the switching energy. This is nice, tends to be very accurate. The problem is it's a pain to do because you have to build a circuit and actually test it. And you have to have somewhat already committed to what MOSFET you want to use if you're going to go test it and then use it in your converter. If you want to compare 10 different MOSFETs, you don't want to have to build a circuit and test all of them. Occasionally, you'll get these curves in the datasheet. For some newer, really good devices, they'll give you, they've already tested this, and they'll give it to you. But it's relatively rare. Okay. So I want to just make some comments on general converter design and optimization. So with what we know now, the total power loss of a converter is equal to any power loss from conduction, which we modeled extensively due to parasitic resistances and then voltage sources in minority carrier devices, plus switching loss that we've looked at a little bit now, a couple of different mechanisms. Conduction loss general is proportional to I or I squared. It's a diode forward voltage, loss is proportional to the current through it. It's a resistance, it can be proportional to I squared. It's going up as the current goes up. Switching losses, more or less proportional to FS. They don't depend on the power level, they just depend on the switching frequency, depending on which voltage is element selection. And then, in general, we'd have some additional fixed losses. Those are relatively small, but things like getting my gate driver to turn on, giving supplies to my controller, anything that doesn't care what your design is, you're just going to have this loss. So these are constant, e.g. my controller. Okay, so if I look over here at efficiency versus my switching frequency, what I see is that as I go lower and lower switching frequency, this term will disappear. My switching losses won't matter because I'm switching so infrequently. These approach zero. And I get just my conduction losses and fixed losses. And as I go up in switching frequency, this term is going to become bigger and bigger, and my efficiency is going to drop. So begs the question, why would I ever go this way? Why would I ever increase the switching frequency of a converter if all it's doing is making my losses larger? Okay. So when we look at selecting a switching frequency, FS, general operation, we're somewhere in between line frequency switching and maybe up to 100 megahertz practically switching. So I know it'd be nice to push this way towards lower switching frequency if I want to reduce switching losses. A good thing down at low frequency is I can have reduced high frequency EMI issues. I am switching a converter at megahertz. It's creating a lot of electromagnetic interference up at a megahertz through these switching actions. And that may be a problem for some systems. Switching it real slow, low frequency EMI is not an issue. We expect a lot of 60 hertz EMI everywhere due to the line. So why in the world, though, would I want to go this way out to higher switching frequency? Any thoughts? Particularly passive, right? So as we've seen up at high frequency, I can do one of two things. I can get less ripple. As we've looked at, my delta I, my delta Vs go down as switching frequency goes up. Or I can keep the same ripple and use a smaller inductor or smaller capacitor to get there. And one other advantage, the higher switching frequency, I'll be able to have faster control. Or equivalently faster response time to disturbances and better regulation. And that's because my only control in these switching converters is changing things like duty cycle, right? Changing my switching actions. So if I am at 60 hertz, I'm switching once per 60 hertz period. After I switch, I can't do anything to control this thing until the next period. My next option to control it is my switching period, duty cycle in the next period. So I can't possibly control this thing any faster than the switching frequency, right? I only get one choice per period. What do I want the duty cycle to be? So I have to control with the bandwidth below the switching frequency. If I go out higher, I can regulate the output, the bandwidth of kilohertz. I'm switching down at 60 hertz. I'm regulating with the bandwidth of 1 hertz. Okay, so it's going to be pretty poorly regulated. So where do things typically fall within this? 60 hertz largely going to be very high power stuff. It's going to be like megawatt range grid converters. A lot of current HVDC converters operate at 60 hertz, the line frequency commutated. As I go up from there, get into the kind of 1 kilohertz to tens of kilohertz range. And here, looking at kind of kilowatt to hundreds of kilowatts IGBT based converters. Things like electric vehicle drivetrains tend to be in this region. Ten kilohertz to 100 kilohertz, and in the multiple hundreds of kilohertz, this is kind of a sweet spot for just my general power supplies. Not quite making it into the megahertz range, but multi hundreds of kilohertz. You get up to switching frequencies in the megahertz. Things like, you know, not even that, but processor power supplies will be up here. Where I need very small ripple, very tightly regulated voltage going to a processor on a computer. As I keep going out here, 100 megahertz range, this is largely kind of a research area. Not many applications practically using something that high. Okay, briefly, when I look at designing a converter, a lot of things that go into that. This plot is becoming a more common way to look at it in power electronics, called the Pareto optimization plot. It's showing efficiency, versus alpha, which is power density. Units of watts per volume. How much power can I cram into a small space? Measure of how small can I make the converter for a given power? Use power density because higher is better, whereas volume lower is better. You want everything to be high, efficiency and power density. So as I look at designing this thing, this point would be my DC asymptote again. And then as I increase switching frequency, I'll move this direction. Initially, I'm very low frequency, my switching losses don't matter. But as I increase switching frequency, my passives get smaller, so my power density gets better. My losses hardly change. Then at some point, I get high enough that continuing to increase my switching frequency causes my efficiency to start rolling off faster as my switching losses become larger than my conduction losses and start to dominate my power loss. At that point, my efficiency is going to begin to tank, and I'll start dropping off. And I'll get very little benefit in power density, even though switching faster might let me keep getting my inductors and capacitors smaller. Because of all this extra loss, I have to put in a bigger cooling system to keep it from overheating. So it actually begins getting purely worse, worse in efficiency and bigger. Okay. This sort of curve would apply to one converter. If I change to a different topology or different devices, I might get on a different curve. This is one facet of trying to design and optimize power converters. Others have to do with device selection. There's an inherent trade-off between conduction and switching losses in the devices you select. And we'll get into that more next class. Have a good weekend.